Trend number two, China's consumer-focused transformation. After decades of growth based on a booming exports business, China must make a difficult transition from an export-driven economy to a consumer-driven economy. Consider that in February, China imported $146 billion worth of goods, an increase of 40% compared to the same month a year earlier. Meanwhile, its exports went up only 18.4% to $114.4 billion. In other words, the country that built the world's second-largest economy by running massive trade surpluses actually posted a trade deficit of more than $30 billion for the month. With worldwide demand growth for its exports slowing, China has no other choice. It must focus on building a strong domestic market for the goods it produces. By creating a huge consumer class within its own borders, China won't need to rely entirely on exports for economic growth or political stability. Let's first discuss how China can make the transition from the export-driven model to a consumer-driven model. Then we will examine how businesses should target the new Chinese consumers. While this transition is inevitable, the question is how China will make the transition without a hard landing that will disrupt the global economy. To understand China's limited range of options, it's important to realize two critical facts about its economy. The first critical fact is that consumption accounts for only a relatively small share of China's gross domestic product. China has an extremely high savings rate because its culture encourages people to save rather than to spend. Because interest rates on savings are tiny, the effect is that its economy has come to rely on cheap capital for its growth. The government takes the money that its population saves and invests it to fuel growth in the country's GDP. As a result, and this is the second critical fact, China has built a mountain of internal debt that many observers believe is unsustainable. According to Michael Pettis, a professor at Peking University's Guangzhou School of Management, who specializes in Chinese financial markets, every country that has used an investment-driven growth model like the one China is still following has created a debt burden that either caused an economic crisis or a lost decade of minimal growth. The only way China can keep its debt from growing is to increase the level of consumption. Pettis also points out that on a global level, there must be an equilibrium between savings and investment. If a country like China has greater savings than investment, other countries must have greater investment than savings. In other words, there must be a balance between countries that are under-consuming and countries that are over-consuming. Until recently, that wasn't a problem for China. While it was under-consuming, the United States and many European countries were over-consuming. But that's no longer the case. Because of the economic downturn, Western countries have cut their consumption. As long as this is the case, the only way to restore equilibrium to the global economy and prevent a catastrophe is for under-consuming countries like China to increase their consumption. And since China is by far the world's leading under-consumer, it will have to make the adjustment, because there are limits both to how much it can borrow and to how much of a trade imbalance other countries will tolerate. For these reasons, China will need to increase consumption as a share of GDP within the next 5 to 10 years. To do that, it will have to reverse the flow of capital. Instead of transferring wealth from Chinese households to the government in the form of high savings rates and low interest rates, China will need to transfer wealth to those households so they will increase their consumption. Pettis identifies 5 strategies that Chinese policymakers could use to enable this change. 1. China can reverse the transfers gradually by slowly increasing real interest rates, the value of the yuan, and wages, or by slowly lowering income taxes and sales taxes. 2. It can reverse the transfers swiftly by abruptly hiking real interest rates, the value of the yuan, and wages, or by quickly lowering income taxes and sales taxes. 3. It can directly transfer wealth from the state sector to the private sector by privatizing assets and then using the money gained from the transactions to increase household wealth. Four, it can assume debt from the private sector as a way of boosting private sector wealth. Or, five, it can slash its investments in production and then create government jobs for people who are put out of work in the process. No matter which of these options China chooses, which might include a hybrid of these alternatives, the effect will be to decrease the government's share of GDP while boosting consumption share. The result will be a growing consumer base with the ability to buy not only Chinese products, but global goods as well. With an eye to this inevitable transition, how should Western companies get ready to approach these newly empowered Chinese consumers? The first step in answering this question is to realize that there are actually three classes of Chinese consumers today. This was one of the major findings emerging from a recent landmark study of Chinese consumers by McKinsey & Company. Over the past 7 years, the consulting firm interviewed more than 60,000 people in 60 Chinese cities as part of its annual consumer surveys. What emerged from this is a comprehensive look at the Chinese consumer of 2020. From 2010 to 2020, the real disposable income per household for Chinese city-dwelling consumers is expected to double from $4,000 to $8,000. This will bring these Chinese to the same standard of living as people living in South Korea. While the urban Chinese will still lag far behind today's Japanese at $26,000 or Americans at $35,000, they will have comparable buying power to Americans as recently as 1950. Just as significantly, McKinsey found that there are currently major differences in income levels among the three classes of Chinese urban consumers they identified. And those differences will continue to exist at the end of the decade, even as the number of people in the upper two classes will grow dramatically. Today, the vast majority of China's population is made up of so-called value consumers, who have annual household disposable incomes between $6,000 and $16,000. That's enough to cover basic living expenses, but not enough for luxuries. The second class of Chinese consumers consists of mainstream consumers with annual household disposable incomes of $16,000 to $34,000. These households, which are similar to what most people think of as the American middle class, have more purchasing power than value consumers. This group represents only 6% of the population, or 14 million households. The third class is even smaller, with just 4.3 million households. These affluent consumers have household incomes of more than $34,000 and represent just 2% of the population. Until now, multinational companies could pursue one of two strategies. One, use their existing business models to market their existing products to the 18 million households in the mainstream and affluent segments. Or two, change their business models to create lower-priced products to target the much bigger market of 184 million households in the value segment. However, by the end of this decade, China's transition toward a consumer-driven economy will create changes in the sizes of these three classes, which will require a rethinking of strategies for selling to them, as we will discuss in a moment. Looking ahead, we offer the following forecasts. First, as wealth shifts from China's government to its households, there will be a massive shift of consumers from the value to the mainstream class. By 2020, McKinsey expects that 51% of the urban population will consist of mainstream consumers, compared to just 6% today. This market will encompass 167 million households, or nearly 400 million individuals, which is a population larger than that of the United States. China's burgeoning mainstream consumers will suddenly be able to buy cars, computers, and other goods that they could not afford when they were in the value segment. This is in line with a World Bank estimate that the number of middle-class consumers in emerging markets will increase to 1.2 billion by 2030 versus 420 million today. In Asia, the World Bank projects spending by the middle class to soar from $5 trillion today to $30 trillion at the end of the next decade. The growth of the mainstream class means that more companies will be able to market their existing products to Chinese consumers without stripping them of features or functions. Second, the proportion of value consumers in China will drop from 82% of households in 2010 to 36% of households in 2020. Companies targeting these consumers with lower-end products will still find a vast market of 116 million households, or 307 million individuals. For companies using a business model that allows them to pursue a low-cost provider strategy, there will still be a fortune at the bottom of the pyramid, even though the base of that pyramid is shrinking. This strategy may also enable multinationals to address the 400 million rural poor that have been largely left behind by China's growth to date. Third, by 2020, the proportion of affluent consumers will grow from 2% to 6% of the urban population. While this may seem like a relatively small market, in a country as large as China, it represents 21 million households with 60 million consumers, and they will have an appetite for luxury goods. Companies targeting these consumers will need to focus on the status and prestige that their offerings provide. Fourth, the government's policies for increasing consumption will stimulate strong growth in consumer purchases in discretionary categories. McKinsey projects annual growth of 13.4% in these categories between 2010 and 2020, as the number of consumers who can afford these goods continues to multiply. For example, sales of luxury SUVs are expected to grow by 20% per year, and the overall Chinese market for luxury cars is expected to grow so fast that it will surpass Japan as the world's number one market as early as 2015. And fifth, in many cases, a sound strategy for multinationals will be to acquire local companies to gain access to their brands and their insights into Chinese consumers. For example, Johnson & Johnson's 2008 acquisition of Beijing Dubao Cosmetics Company allowed it to take over a brand with a loyal consumer following rather than trying to compete with it, as the buying power of China's three consumer classes, totaling 767 million people, continues to surge. The value of such acquisitions will soar, and the bidding for them will intensify.